Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Hey, everybody. I am super stoked to have Sarah Billups on the podcast today. She's written an incredible book that, Sarah, there were moments where I was like, we can just change out some of the pronouns, scratch the name out, you know, for this town or that town. And I really felt like for much of the book, I was reading my story. But this is called Orphaned Believers, How a Generation of Christian Exiles Can Find the Way Home. Thanks for writing in this and thanks for coming on today.
Oh, Alexis, thanks for having me. I'm so happy to be here and to talk to you.
Yeah, I didn't tell you before we started recording, but there I was like real tempted to just say, okay, we don't really have to record this, right? I'm going to pour myself a cup of coffee and let's just talk about our experiences, because this book was written by someone who came of age. This is 80s, 90s. You're in Sunday school, you're in youth group in American white evangelicalism.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
I mean, so I think my first, how I'd love it if you could get us started is, you know, I'm kind of jokingly saying like this book is my story. So I feel like it was written for me, but who did you have in mind when you were choosing? Cause it's kind of part your story and then I'll let you tell what it's about, but who did you have in mind when you decided this is the story that I want to tell, this is the book I want to write?
Yeah. That's a great question. When I was writing the book, I began to explore some things that happened to me coming up in the Midwest, as you said, in the 80s and 90s. And I realized that we're in a moment of history in the American church, specifically in the white evangelical American church, when we're struggling to come to terms with what that means. And so I've, you know, been in Seattle for 18 years, and in that time, seen many friends leave church, struggle with talking about faith, trying to grapple with or hang on to believing in Jesus, as there's many broken things surrounding the church. And I was writing it for folks who, like me, are looking around the American church and trying to find Jesus and wondering where Jesus is. So folks who are in a middle space, who are trying to be faithful and yet are struggling and maybe are a little lonely. It can feel like a pretty isolating place to be when you're either culturally orphaned, like when you're maybe living in the Bible Belt, and everyone talks about being a Christian, but you're not feeling a lot of like real formation. And then, or maybe you live in a progressive place. I've lived in both kind of places where you have to explain what it means when you say you're a Christian, and that's really exhausting. Or I think about folks who are spiritually orphaned, people that believe in Jesus, but maybe feel like they've been hung out to dry in the church, or who can't like square their reading of the gospel with what they see around them. So those are the kinds of people I was thinking of, folks that are looking around and trying to find Jesus, either holding on to their faith or wondering what happened in the midst of our complicated culture.
Yeah, thanks. And I want to share, you know, it's not really a spoiler alert. I think you open and in the book with this, but I just want to, I would love for you to share a little bit, because through all of this story that we'll get into as we continue in this conversation, you're still a Christian and you're still in the church.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the Bible Belt, sometimes, I don't know how it looks in other places, but sometimes in the Bible Belt, we hear things like, oh, well, you know, I believe in Jesus, but I'm so burned out on the church that now my church looks like, you know, I drink coffee on my deck and watch the sunrise, or, you know, I do these things, but, and there's nothing wrong with drinking coffee on your sun, you know, watching the sunrise on your porch. I love that. But what we hear, and what I mean by that, is there are a lot of individualistic, independent activities that people are calling the church. And number one, my heart is broken. I've experienced church hurt too. And so I know all experiences are different, but I resonate with that kind of that desire to just say, forget it. This is it. It's just me and Jesus. But as a student, as a specifically as a theology student, I kind of have a real theological issue with that, you know, kind of framing of that. And so, you know, you don't have to have the same, you don't have to agree with that, but I would kind of like to open that up and say, you're a Christian. You still are part of a church. Yep. And like, why though?
Yeah. I mean, when I think about the church, I mean, the church is what Jesus, like what Christ left us with, you know? And so if this whole thing is true, like if I am building my life around the belief that there really was a virgin birth, an actual resurrection, like if Jesus was bodily resurrected from the dead, like if these wild, audacious claims really happened and they are how I'm flanking and centering my life, it means that I am called to be a part of Christ's body. And the way that manifests is that we have the church. And I think that if that's true, a remnant of the church will always be here to stay. And the question is, what do we do with it? You know? And so this is such a good and tender question, because I think what I've learned over the past many years is that we're all in really different places. If we have the gift of long life, we can go through seasons that are really spiritually dry. I mean, I would say that I wandered through a spiritual desert it was 12 years. It was 12 years when I felt very bewildered and confused and was just treading water. I mean, if my faith was like under a bowl, it was like the flame was like barely lit for a long time. But I realized that the thing about the church, the gathered body of believers, is that I don't get to be in control of who I worship with. I'm with people that maybe I wouldn't choose to go to brunch with, like people that maybe I wouldn't even necessarily relate to, but like that I end up loving. So that's such a beautiful embodied experience, to go to church, to like stand in the communion line with people that you didn't pick, that you're challenged by, that make you grow, that make you question yourself. It's very uncomfortable. And that's very sort of, that's sort of un-American in a way, because we're not kind of customizing it. And it's messy. And I think that any church, even the best church, the most perfect church it doesn't exist. Like even in healthy churches, there's plenty to criticize. But I think that the other thing about my experience is that in Seattle, usually folks don't go to church by accident. Like it's uncommon to go to church here. And so if you decide to, there's usually an intentionality. But having grown up in Indiana and the Midwest, I've experienced the other side of that, where everybody went to church, but it felt very flat. So I guess I just say that if you have a heart that's burning to change things, if you can work to reform the church from within, if you're in a healthy church, that's like a beautiful calling. And I think we need to move into that work if we can. But the personal experience of where other folks are, if they're taking a break or if they're in an unhealthy situation, I mean, as we both know, it's so broad and nuanced that I talk about it in a tender way, but in a way that hopefully is encouraging and inspiring, with like kind of a longer view of life and of seasons of life, but with a hope and desire that those of us in healthy places can like actually work to make space for other people to come and flourish.
Yeah, that was like, you know, so much more beautifully articulate than I asked that question. So I appreciate that. Yeah, and you know, two things there that I kind of like, and B, I'm also in the communion line and people are going, yeah, I wouldn't have picked her. Right. Like, just as you say, like, this is a reciprocal kind of thing, right? Yeah, like realizing that I'm that person to people that I'm standing in line with too. And that's beautiful, right? That's really great. They get to choose to stand in line with me is amazing. And yes, that there are, you know, there are seasons when people do need a break. And so I don't mean to minimize that at all. You know, when we had come out of two kind of situations that had some really hard kind of toxic aspects to them. And afterwards, I borrowed a phrase that I had heard a Bible study teacher say about her love life. And she used to say, my picker is broken. Mm-hmm. And I told my husband, I'm like, here's the deal. When it comes to church, my picker is broken. Like, you know, like I'm just not doing this well. And, you know, and so I was basically just kind of like, I can't even have much of an opinion on this other than the fact that I think we need to be in a place. Right. I was lucky in that I had a partner who could help me navigate that situation, you know, where otherwise, you know, left to my own devices, I don't know, you know, what season I would be in right now. Right. It is really tough. And I think it's also common, as you talk about in the book, because we orphaned believers have come, we've been kind of homegrown in spaces that have yielded mm-hmm. what we're experiencing mm-hmm. right now.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that when you were talking, I was thinking about how, I'll say first, when it comes to Christian conversion, I do believe that there's agency and decision and choice, that because we are free, we make a choice to follow God. I think that's beautiful. That's such a restorative, hopeful posture and moment. And, you know, my dad is Jewish, grew up in a Reformed family, got saved in the 70s in a very dramatic way. He was at a Bible study. He was at a low point in his life. He had divorced my mom after being married for 6 months. Something kind of caught in him after a few weeks. He just felt like he like was in this like small apartment in Fort Wayne, Indiana, like leapt over the couch, ran to the parking lot in this apartment complex and like fell on his like face and like surrendered to Jesus, like this beautiful, powerful conversion. So I think that is important and theologically grounded. But I also think that in evangelical culture, sometimes we grow up with like an individual salvation narrative, like culturally, and the way that it makes us as kids unsure whether or not we really are saved. And I think, you know, many of us grew up asking Jesus into our heart every night, like I did many, many nights, weeks, months, and years in case we weren't really saved. So there's a fear that creeps in quickly. And there's something so beautiful, like you were saying, about looking for church with your husband. Like we can carry each other. Like there's a beautiful communal aspect of church and of relationships if we're blessed to be in them. Or there, you know, in those 12 years of spiritual desert for me, like my husband really carried me. And that was a beautiful like grace and a gift. There's times when I've carried him. Like I think we can carry each other in times of doubt and I think that's a little bit against the sort of narrative, like of an individualistic American kind of almost consumerist like narrative about salvation culturally. So not theologically, but culturally. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, for sure. And I'm so glad that you brought up your dad, because he is a central character in your book, and we learn a lot about your dad and about your formation through your experience of him as a parent. And so for this, I will say this is actually a true, you know, kind of spoiler. Like your dad is going through some health problems, and so that was one of the first things that I checked in about. And you said you had just gone off the phone with him. So praise the Lord.
My dad was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, which is a treatable but not curable form of cancer, of bone cancer, blood cancer. So the treatment is hard, but he's doing well. So with my dad, you know, we got saved in the 70s really radically, but it was also in a time culturally when there was this book, The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey, that was just burning off the shelves, that was selling millions of copies, like more copies than The Joy of Sex, top of the New York Times bestseller list. And it was the time when there were Christian scare movies and like more broadly in culture with the Red Scare and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Like there was just this sort of apocalyptic fear, like Ronald Reagan was talking about, used apocalyptic language in a couple of speeches. You know, so there was a fear of the future of the world. And so that really flavored my dad's conversion from Judaism to Christianity. And so I grew up hearing a lot about the end times and had a fear of the rapture. And so interestingly, my dad now, decades later, still believes, he is a rational, reasonable person who loves Jesus, who believes he will be raptured before cancer ends his life. And that the emotion of that for me, the reality of his belief and how I square that with his illness, is really interesting and complicated, and really invited a lot of reflection for me about what it means to grow up with a parent who has that kind of posture or belief.
Yeah. So maybe we can kind of pause there, because when you talked about Hal Lindsey, which, believe it or not, I don't know, I think we're both seminarians right now. You're going for your demon and I'm going for my MDiv. And I had to read a couple of chapters from Late Great Planet Earth for one of my classes. I'm serious. Of course, I will say this. This was a how not to. Okay. So it was like,
met anyone else that's read it from like my generation. I read it too, because I thought, I mean, I grew up hearing about it. It's time. So it was interesting. Yeah.
I did not read the whole thing. I think I read, chapters 5 and 6 or something, but it was for
skimmable, for sure.
Oh yeah. It was for an Old Testament class, and it's wild, right? I mean, it's rich and it's wild, but this is one of the, so your book is broken up into 3 sections. And the first one is End Times. And I am here to tell you, like, I don't know how many nights I like was skipping the TV. I was skipping my screens because I was like, Sarah, this is so intense. Like this was my life, right? Like this End Times section was my life. And then you've got a really rich section that you just explore culture wars and what that has looked like in American evangelicalism, probably from a little bit before you and I were actually in it, but kind of what we were born into, I might say, through the 2020s. And then consumerism, which, I mean, goodness, I want to get there. But I'm feeling like we might want to start a bit with the end times, as you did in the book, because it shaped your dad. It continues to shape your dad. And it shaped me too. I mean, I can't tell you how many nightmares I had as a kid, a youth group kid, who grew up in this, watching these terrifying movies. I mean, I feel like I can't even say it. I feel like I might need to have like a blurb here. Like, these were movies, I can't remember if you mentioned or not, but this was like, if you didn't get raptured and you were still here in these movies, like these kids knew that they were going to have to be decapitated, right? Like they would be beheaded if they wanted to be saved, if they wanted to join Jesus. This is terrifying.
Yeah,
it really terrifying stuff. And this was like church youth group. Like we couldn't watch Chucky or Friday the 13th, but let's throw these rapture movies on and pop the popcorn. Like, Sarah, this shaped us.
I know. It's funny how, I mean, so I went back and watched A Thief in the Night just to refresh my memory. Wow. Seeing the guillotine scene at the end. Yes. I guess that's a spoiler, but maybe that's an appropriate spoiler.
That's like, an appropriate spoiler. Don't watch it.
as a 40-something, like, of course it seems kitschy and kind of like, like if I had just seen it now, I'd think this is ridiculous. It feels so much like the 70s and 80s. It has like it's very dated. It just seems silly and kind of laughable. But like as a child, seeing these things in formative years, it truly was terrifying. It really was quite an experience. And so I write in the book, and it's like one of my first memories, like literally one of my first memories is, I was in my living room and my dad had talked about not taking the mark of the beast. I was maybe 4 years old. I don't know, maybe five. I think I was probably four. And so I traced 666 on my forehead because that's what he had talked about not doing. I don't know why. I ran out into the backyard and my mom was like hanging laundry and I burst into tears and I said, "Mom, I'm going to hell." You know, and she just like held me and I was sobbing. This is like as a, before I started school, like this has been printed in my brain, you know? And so I think that I'm just framing that dramatic moment to say like, many of us have a moment like that. My husband had one. He remembers being maybe 8 or 9, like crying in the backseat of his car when his dad said that he wouldn't grow up and have a family or start a career because he would be raptured. And so parents don't do that because it's like mean or they didn't understand. They didn't think that they were trying to be like somehow abusive or infuse terror in us. They did it because they felt like, I mean, at least I can speak for, I think my dad would say, and he's since told me, I'm sorry. He's apologized in adulthood many times for making these choices. But I think he did that because he felt like it was his duty to make sure I wasn't left behind, you know? And so I understand that. And my dad and I have worked that out and I've certainly done that work, but really looking back, thinking like, how was I formed? How were many of us formed by fear as opposed to by like love and the presence of Jesus and prayer and community and celebration, those true good things. I was formed by like the mall and TGIF on Friday nights on the TV. And by like a fear of the world ending, like I was formed by culture and by church, and those kind of got, they kind of bled into each other in my young mind.
Yeah. I mean, they continue to though, right? I mean,
you can pull that thread all the way through. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. What were you going to say?
Oh, just that, an interesting thing about being an end times kid for me is that there was part of, so I was terrified, but then there's this part of you that kind of gets the script down. Like, Jesus, like the, this is a premillennial dispensationalism, right? This is the idea that was popularized by John Nelson Darby starting in the 1800s in the UK and then really landed in America when the wars happened. Because before then in the 20s, during like the social gospel, there was a lot of optimism that we could work to make the world better. But then when the wars happened, there was obviously disillusionment and a lot of loss. And so these ideas took root more like, let's escape, like Jesus come back because things are really bad. And so that makes sense culturally. But when I was a little bit older, I was still afraid of these things, but I also began to metabolize the reality of the rapture and had a script and I could talk about the 7-year tribulation period. I could tell you exactly what happened. And I have this like vivid memory in high school when I still believed in a literal rapture and premillennial dispensationalist kind of mantra that I was sitting in this ice cream shop with my best friend in high school. And we were sitting in a booth in the back of the shop. She had a banana split and I was going through the script because I felt like I had a duty to tell her what would happen so she wouldn't be left behind. And like, by the time I got to talking about the Battle of Gog and Magog, like her spoon just like suspended in midair and her mouth like dropped open. Like, what am I, like, what is she? It was just, it's very comical thinking back now, but really like, I felt like I had a duty to share this message, just like my dad felt like he had a duty to tell me even as a 4-year-old kid. And the other thing that crept in was this feeling of exceptionalism. I was very melodramatic and theatrical for me, how I talked to my friend in high school about the Battle of Gog and Magog. But I also felt like this sense of like, I know what's going to happen. I have a duty because I know Jesus will return in my lifetime. But there's also this sense of exceptionalism that can kind of tell me like, wow, it feels interesting and almost kind of exciting in this sort of weird way to know what's going to happen. And I think that's the thread we can pull on towards Christian nationalism today and conspiracy theorists. Like when you think you know how it's going to go down, there's a feeling of control and of power that comes, even if you wouldn't vocalize it like that. That really is about security and feeling like we can know what's going to happen. And maybe that means that environmentalism is less important. Like maybe creation care is less top of mind. I mean, I was certainly raised thinking Earth Day is something you can ignore and it's maybe new agey. and the world's going to end anyways. So there's all sorts of relevant applications decades later to what happened to a lot of us in those decades, the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. There's social implications and cultural implications for sure. There are environmental even implications, you know, and I think that, I mean, I don't know how kind of if we want to go there, but I'll just throw it out. And if not, we can not talk about it, or we can even edit it. But, you know, one of those things for me, and it's personality too, right? So my spiritual director this week was talking about Enneagram stuff. And mm-hmm. she was like, I think I want you just to kind of sit in this six space, because, you know, sixes, many of them are really fear, you know, driven and, you know, things like this, but, you know, take that or leave it. Personality wise, I was a very fearful kid, right? And experienced a lot of anxiety anyway. And my parents weren't the ones who introduced me to this. It was my youth group, you know, like just my youth group stuff, right? This was what was taught. And so I would say it had for me theological implications. Mm-hmm. Because then I'm growing and trying to figure out is this something? And I think now the question I might ask, if I'm going to be real blunt and even kind of maybe too imprecise, is this something I even need to hold in tension? Right. Yeah. Because then I start going, Jesus loves me. This I know, for the Bible tells me so. He loves me so much that he's going to make sure that my head has to be cut off by a guillotine if I happen to be left behind because I didn't say the right words the 40th time that I asked him to come into my heart because I missed that one thing I should have said in the sinner's prayer. And so when I'm left behind, you know, my nightmare was literally that I was left behind taking care of my disabled aunt, that it was the two of us who were left. And I was, you know, 15 or whatever, trying to figure out how to get to her home and, you know, care for her. Right. Because my entire rest of the family were real Christians and they were gone. And so I'm going, how do I hold this? What did I learn? And I have words for it now, right? But what was I learning about Jesus and who he is that this would be what I would be kind of forced to go through? And for me, it didn't feel theoretical, right? At the time, it felt very real. And so I I'm gonna throw that out there to you as someone, you know, like you were still walking through this. You know, we're still Christians and we're still in the church, right? So what does this mean even for us theologically about how we were formed by these end times perspectives?
Yeah, that's so good. I think there's a joy in participating in God's work of caring for God's kingdom, of bringing God's kingdom and reality into the here and now, into the present. And I think that advocating for change, praying for our cities, like doing redemptive work to make the world better, looping back to that kind of 1920s like social gospel stance, I think that that's like a real beautiful kind of counteractive measure to sort of work against whatever has taken root in some of us that has this sort of anticipatory fear, or at least theology around the world getting worse. Like, I think that there's still something wired in me. Things are getting worse. And my job is to, in a present local way, try to make things better as kind of a way to counteract that. So that's about as far as I go. Like, I think end times culture had that, again, that fear created from the Cold War and the world ending. But the other thing I would say is that formation like grounds us in Jesus in the present as well. And so, like you mentioned, your director, I mean, to not withdraw from the world, but to embrace it, not to immerse ourselves in it, but to not embody a posture of fear, but to say, like, how can I be present and actually with my life bear witness to God's goodness and redemption? Again, in the here and now. It just feels like a floaty answer, but that's where I am to kind of counteract that narrative of grown up.
Yeah. No, that's good. Yeah. I mean, there's just so much there, right? There's so much there, but I think that, you know, as you transitioned, and we can transition there now or not, but as you transition from your end time section into the culture war section, I mean, this is, it's you're opening the door and just going into the next room, right? Because this is all, it's so interconnected because now you've got a place where we've been, even American evangelicals, specifically white American evangelicals, have been formed in these ways by this is shaping how we understand ourselves inside of culture. As you said, like, I'm sitting here having ice cream with my friend, and this is what I feel like my duty is. This is what I need to do. And then we all aged and we can vote and we can have these conversations on an adult level, and we're leading Sunday school classes and we're becoming politically active, and we've been shaped and are continuing to be shaped by these perspectives. And then now we have, I mean, I'm not even talking 2020, 2016. I mean, we can go back to, I remember voting in my first presidential elections. Mm-hmm. And I'll just go ahead and say it. It's not going to be a shocker to anybody. I cared about probably one or maybe two things, right? Mm-hmm. What is the guy's stance? And of course it was always a guy. What is the guy's stance on abortion?
Yep.
Right? Which box should I check? And then I don't know if I had any other, stances. And my,
yep,
my dad is like wringing his hands right now. He's like, oh my goodness, how could, you know, he's like, I've evolved, Dad. You know, I have. But anyway, but you know, this was not at all politically how he kind of brought me up to think about those things. But I was really formed by some of the stuff that we just chatted about, and that led to, you know, kind of single issue type of stuff, right? Because environmentalism wasn't on the ballot for me.
That's right.
Even though I was really cared about social justice, I mean, I have a master's degree in social justice. It still felt very separate from my faith because of how the evangelical culture is in America. So, I mean, how did those connect for you?
Yeah.
In life and in the book, how did this connect for you?
Yeah. When I turned 18, on my literal 18th birthday, my dad took me to the Allen County Republican headquarters in downtown Fort Wayne, Indiana. I was registered as a card-carrying Republican. I got a literal actual card, a little paper card. And then we went and had chili dogs at Fort Wayne's famous Coney Island next door. I mean, it was like, there was never a question that evangelicals voted Republican, that Christians like us had a duty, that voting, representing the unborn, was what the multitude of voices that were not able to vote or have a presence or experience life was our duty. And because of that, no other issue really mattered. This issue blanketed over all of the other issues. And so I talk in the book about how my mom got pregnant when she was 17, is Italian and was raised in Chicago, and was sent to a home in Columbus, a Catholic Charities home, where she had a baby. And had to sign the papers, never meeting the child, and the child was given up for adoption joyfully and wonderfully. We've reconnected. When my brother turned 18, he was able to find us. So that's actually a really wonderful end to that story. But there was so much shame involved in the story of my mom when she was so young. And I think that because of that, as well, there was this real personal layer to adoption and to our duty to think about not only opposing abortion, but also to doing the work that we can to protect lives. And so my mom volunteered at a crisis pregnancy center. And, you know, every year we would get this Christmas card in the mail that had the names of the baby's lives that were saved. And we put it on the fridge. And then I never once thought, what happened to these kids, like, after they were born? Like, we, you know, and this is not a new idea. Like, this is actually wonderfully talked about by many Christians right now, especially after the overturning of Roe. It's just like, what happens to a child? What is our duty for whole life care? And not just for babies, but also for immigrants and refugees. Like, what is our real value of life? And so the sort of squaring away, like, how I vote and as an adult, as a person that has political opinions, like you said, who might teach Sunday school, who has a life where I'm raising my own kids. Like, how do I talk about and think about a real biblical way forward with voting that believes that life is life, and that all life deserves to be a thing that we can support and that we can come alongside as the church and not just sort of be stuck on an issue. And I guess the last thing I'd say about abortion is just how really new of an issue it is. And I think that, you know, I didn't realize until researching the book that it wasn't until there was a political strategist named Paul Weyrich in the 70s that was really looking for an issue that would stick with evangelical voters, and abortion was that thing. And so the rise of the religious right and the sort of marrying of republicanism and evangelicalism around abortion is still a pretty fresh thing that it's been like all of our life if we're middle-aged or younger. And so it feels like it's always been there, but it really hasn't in the long history of the church and even of America. So I also try to put context from like timing around it.
Yeah. I mean, that's really important and beautifully stated, you know, so it's not about saying, oh, well now I'm going to find every, you know, I'm just going to start voting in an opposite way or something like that. Right. But it is about a holistic, you know, perspective. And it's really troubling. You talk about it a little bit here, and it has been troubling for me for probably since I was a teenager, because I'm like, if an alien came down and you just said, I need you to guess what these two phrases mean, pro-choice and pro-life, mm-hmm. like they wouldn't get it right. Right. Like if an English speaking alien came down, right? Like they wouldn't get it right because, you know, those, and of course those are, you know, political names, yeah. Right, for even the positions. But it is, you know, frustrating, and I'm grateful, as you mentioned, this is becoming a topic that's being talked about a lot more, you know, especially, yes, the turn of overturn of Roe, but also you know, in these past few years with the awareness of what's happening at the border, of, you know, especially with, you know, children being separated from their families, with, you know, refugees, the refugee population and internally displaced people is just keeps growing. And I think a lot more people, you know, my issue on this when I was a teenager was I was doing a position paper on the death penalty against. And I interviewed my pastor as one of my sources because we were encouraged to have a variety of sources for this researched position paper. And I just knew that he was going to back up my position. And you just know that he did not back up my position whatsoever. But even thinking about that as a, like a pro-life being the phrase, like, yes, I am so grateful that now this is 25 years later, you know, like that, that more and more Christians are talking about what does it mean to be pro-life, but pro all of
life, amen. Right? Holistically pro-life.
Holistically pro-life. And that those values are something that we can start talking about culturally and not just in voting. I know that you didn't mean that, but like, you know, in all of our lives, how are we carrying this conversation and these actions with us and forward?
Amen. Yeah. That's right.
Yes. So, can we, while we're here for just a minute, can we talk about Christian nationalism?
Yeah.
I mean, for just yeah. 2 seconds. I mean,
enthusiastic.
That may not leave us much time for consumerism, but I'm just going, this is another part of these culture wars, right? And most of us probably watched the insurrection, right? January 6th, 2021. And we saw the things that you describe in the book. So how did this hit you? What given your experiences and, you know, what you were writing for the book, like how did all of that strike you? What are you doing with that?
Yeah. I mean, the truth is I moved to Seattle 18 years ago. I spent the first 12 of those years kind of flailing around, kind of culturally trying to understand how to live in a place where it was complicated to talk about being a Christian. When the 2016 election happened. And then moving forward, I realized, oh, I think I have something to say. I think that my experience growing up is something that is not just mine, but has bigger implications about the church. And just watching what was happening, I began to realize, I think that I have something to share that might resonate with people. And so for me, it was even 2 years ago, a time where I was just beginning to figure out how to talk about these things. And for me, when I talk about nationalism or any other piece of politics or culture that is kind of connected to the church or affiliated with it, like, I think it's our responsibility to like root these things out, like to bring everything to light, to surface abuse, to talk about sort of how republicanism has in many ways enmeshed in evangelicalism, how nationalism has risen, because we want to surface those things to bring them out of the church, because we want to come back around to Jesus. And so the work that we're calling, I don't think, is to burn it all down, but to say, let's take everything that's false and that is an arrow away from the revolutionary work and life of Jesus, and let's root that out and come back to like a flourishing faith that is formed on good and true things, that is formed on biblical hope, and the challenge and goodness of that. So when the insurrection happened, I had already been thinking about this book and writing a little bit about these ideas publicly. And I just began to think a lot about the history of the church. And again, I mentioned communion, like when we stand in that line, thinking about all the people that have come before us and the folks that will come after us is really beautiful. But you know, if the Christian story is 2000 some years old, like, if that's true, it means that it is so much older and deeper and broader than America, and that if that means God is concerned with the flourishing of all people in all countries and places. So I began to explore and think more about the global church and just trying to figure out how to broaden our perspective a bit and contrast that with what happened during the insurrection and with the rise of nationalism. And you know, now we see that there's some popular books that talk about Christian nationalism being a positive thing. But to me, it is clear that that Christian nationalism is like this false belief that God works through nations. It's not the belief that God works through nations, but the belief that God is uniquely concerned with America and with the prospering of this place more than any other place. And that, because really we know that God works everywhere and all across all time. So this idea that God has this special like place or love for America, I think is not grounded in biblical orthodoxy, you know? And so the gospel having spread for as long as it has is beautiful and depthful and certainly existed before the US. So if the gospel is true, that means that it's true for all places and times, not just this one. So that's sort of why I felt really compelled and inspired to dig a little deeper in the book. Think about that.
I think that's a wise way to look at it, is to broaden our scope, right? I think my initial perspective was to kind of like hone in, right? Like, what is happening right now? What is, you know, what is going on in this one space and time? Which I think is valid to kind of study something like that up close. But what I'm hearing you say, I really love, it's just like, let's broaden, right? Let's broaden what the Christian faith is, who we are, what is the gospel, right? And when we look at this in a very broad way, then we can kind of see ourselves and our country in this perspective, right? Of this much larger global Christian story that was and is continuing. And will exist past whenever America exists, right? Like, this is, it's going to keep going. It existed long before and it will continue to exist.
That's right. As you were talking, I was thinking of this MLK quote, that the church should remember, or like must be reminded, that it's not the servant or master of the state. I'm not getting it perfect, but that the church is the conscience of the state, you know? And so how do we think about it with that frame? And he said that like in the 60s. And so that was so forward thinking. But it seems like we're struggling as a church because instead of expressing moral courage, and that Jesus chooses a different way, that we're really conflating church and politics to kind of I think some people would say to maintain dominance or to maintain control or to keep America a white-facing nation when we know demographically that that is changing and that is a beautiful thing, welcoming diverse perspectives, immigrant and refugee voices. I mean, that there's, I think, a threat to some folks. And I don't know that people, I don't know, I want to be careful because I don't know that somebody, I think some people would say, I'm a nationalist, I think Christianity should dominate, and I think I should feel like I'm in power if Christianity is in power. But really, like the lived experience of someone, I don't know that family members of mine that I think are relating to nationalism would even say I'm a Christian nationalist. I think some folks would, but I think many folks would just think, I believe that God has a special place for America, like God has had a special place for Israel, and things will flourish here because of that. There's sort of a special blessing, and I just don't see a biblical grounding for that. And I think that there's sort of lighter ways that nationalism filters in, even if it's not being preached directly from the pulpit and all over the place, you know?
Yeah, I do. And I'll just say right here that I actually was, I'm kind of taking some notes here, and I'm going to put in the show notes a book and an interview that I did with a guy named Paul Miller, who's a professor at Georgetown. Who, I don't know if you can help me with the name of his book, Sarah. Now
I was like, just looking at it last night. That's so funny.
Yeah, it's leaving me now, but it's a fantastic, deep dive from a scholar who is a believer as well, who worked in Bush administrations and things like, you know, ex-military, all of this. It's an incredible book where he really does get in. And even you say this, you're like, there are even different definitions for what Christian nationalism even means, right? And so I'm just going to throw that out there and say, for people who might kind of want to dive a little bit deeper into that, I have found Paul Miller, his book to be a really great resource for that. And it helped me, I would say what it did for me was just kind of help me think about it better, you know, because I felt like I was kind of grasping at straws. Like, I know there's something happening, but like, what is it? And I felt like Paul kind of helped give me some language and help me understand and think about it in a kind of a better way than I was thinking about it before. So I'll put that in the show notes as well. Yeah,
absolutely. It does feel muddy sometimes, Alexis. Like, if I post about nationalism on Instagram, for example, usually somebody will say, there's nothing wrong with being a patriot. And I'll say, I mean, I'm a patriot too. Like, patriotism is love of country. That is not the same thing as conflating sort of God's blessing on America with being proud of your country. So there's nuance and definition that I think it's important for us to get clear on. And I think Paul's book is an awesome resource. It's a great idea.
Yeah, it's really good. So yeah, thanks for clarifying that as well. Sarah, I don't think we're going to have the moments to dig into consumerism like I really wanted to. And I have got some things starred in that chapter. So, or in those chapters in that section of the book. Maybe the last thing I'll ask, and then I want to give you an opportunity to kind of say what you want to say after that and kind of close it however you want to. But one of the themes of your book that I thought really, kind of held things together for me and helped me have a healthier perspective than I might if I was just recollecting on some parts of my own story, if I could say it that way, is that this theme of liturgy. Mm-hmm. And you say more than one place, I think, but this statement that liturgy is the work of the people. Mm-hmm. And that it's for everyone. Mm-hmm. And by that, you don't necessarily mean repeating things in high church, right? Yep. But it can be, and that can be included in that. So can you just, I don't know, give us a little flavor of what that, you know, why did that make the book? Why is that theme so important to you running through these topics?
Yeah, we can't resist kind of just to talk about consumerism, to say that there are forces in the market that shape us, you know, and we can't resist those things if we're not shaped by the inside out, you know, so I think that formation and sort of right liturgy is like a vitamin or an inoculation against the market or consumerism or things that seek to form us instead of Jesus. You know, those things are not bad. I mean, I joke that I grew up going to the mall on Saturdays as a kid and the service on Sunday. I went to church on Sunday. That those are not things that are bad. I mean, I was at the mall grabbing Christmas gifts the other day. It is just about sort of a mindset and posture and how that forms us. And so, you know, I think that, I mean, I've gone to an Anglican church I've gone to the same church for 18 years. We were Presbyterian and now Anglican. So like liturgy is something comfortable to me, literally, but it is certainly not, liturgy does certainly not only mean like the smells and bells and like stuff of high church. It just means looking at how we're formed. And I think I say in the book how we're all living out liturgies all the time, which just again means work of the people. And so our work, my work and my family growing up in the suburbs in the 80s and 90s was like, I was just kind of joke, like it was about the Super Bowl shuffle or like leg warmers or spandex. We had all sorts of like jazzercise liturgies. Like I kind of play around with it a little bit, but like really the work that we do with formation, like having liturgies in our life that form us, can give us wisdom and can give us perspective and can be a healthy way to kind of combat other forces. And so the truth is that liturgies help us to remain rooted in Christ as opposed to rooted in our political party or the market or any other thing around us. And also I think that it can help us to not be defensive and to be wise. And so if we see racism or nationalism or a false ideology creep up, we can use formation and sort of healthy liturgies and practice, again, to fortify against some of those broader cultural things that can creep in. So I think that's really beautiful. And I think that can be done individually as well as communally, just sort of pointing an arrow back to what we were talking about church and the health of community and practicing our faith together.
Yeah, thank you for that. What would you say to someone who, you know, resonates with the title of this book? They think, oh, orphan believers. I think that's me. I think I might be in their generation, and those experiences sound familiar. And maybe they're kind of unsure of where that leaves them, you know, whether, you know, maybe they still go to church every single Sunday, maybe their heart's there, maybe it's not, but they're kind of, you know, realizing some of these things helped form them. Yeah. What would you say to them?
Yeah. I think I would start by saying it may feel lonely, but you're not alone. That I don't know anyone who has not had a severed or strange relationship with someone in their family or with maybe like a former pastor or youth group leader, someone that they know that has been a mentor. Many of us have experienced broken or strained relationships over political difference or over the state of the church right now. And the goodness of the Christian story, again, like I said earlier, if it is true, it is such a beautiful transformational thing. So following the message of Jesus, I think is grounding and brings us to a greater community. And so I think I would say to seek other people, even if it's harder triggering, if you can, if that felt safe, to not give up, to talk to people, to talk out loud, to think about other specific practical ways that you can continue to be formed. I mean, Alexis, you mentioned spiritual direction. That has been very transformational to me. There are people that say I can't, that have told me I can't pray right now. And so I think that if that is true, or if you don't know how to pray anymore, like just reading a psalm, like, you know, like Eugene Peterson has a beautiful, I mean, the message, maybe some parts feel dated, but I think it's such a beautiful, like, grounded translation of the psalm. So just like sitting and reading or listening, reading liturgy or the daily office, just ingesting good things, just sitting in quiet, even if you can, just starting really small is really wonderful. So I think I'd say some of that, but also if it helps to know that there are some of us here that are choosing to pursue relationship with Jesus and to ground our lives around that good message, of love of neighbor, of love of the world, because we are putting our hope not in ourselves or our own success, but in the beautiful message that we can be changed and grow and be of service to one another through the Christian story, then yeah, you're not the only one. And even if it feels lonely, to persevere, to hold on, because I think that it's worth it. I'm convicted that it is.
Amen. Me too. Sarah, thank you so much for being with me today. I really just enjoyed this book so much. I'm appreciative. It's really generous of you to share your story with us. And I don't take that lightly. And so I appreciate you doing that and weaving your own story through these other really important, tough topics.
Thank you. It's been such a joy to be with you. And I've loved this conversation, Alexis. Thanks so much.
I'm so glad. This is Orphaned Believers. I'm going to put the link to this in the show notes for where you can find this. Orphaned Believers, How a Generation of Christian Exiles Can Find the Way Home. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.